Well, this week we are going to do really the impossible, I suppose, which is try in a single week to explore the interconnection between class and gender and class and race. Each of these topics could be a major module in this course. As I went through my notes and revised them and revisited some of the theoretical issues involved in fully understanding at the conceptual level how to approach the connection between different forms of oppression, it just seemed like this was so many interesting ramifications for both of these topics, and they figure so large directly and indirectly in so many current debates that it really is a shame to try to pack it in so tightly. As I bemoaned on other occasions, the consequence of condensing a leisurely two-semester course into a marathon one-semester class has just been having to cut things out and squish things together. So these are certainly central issues. In a funny way, I would suppose the class and gender of all the topics we're doing, there's probably more written around that problem, among critical thinkers, around the class-gender cluster, than almost anything else we're dealing with. So in the next block of the course, we're going to deal with questions of class formation, collective action, class solidarity. That's actually not such a big topic these days. I mean, it should be, but it's not. It's not at the center of social theory and social science, whereas gender issues certainly are. One way of thinking about this whole enterprise is the following. So in the last session, we talked about complexities inside of class, right? So we start with this abstract, simple, polarized concept of class. We want to study concrete problems in the world, and that simple polarized concept isn't satisfactory. And one strategy for dealing with the explanatory weakness of that very abstract concept is to render that concept more concrete and complex systematically, to produce systematic complexity interior to the concept of class. And that's what I attempted to do with my various versions of contradictory class locations and then other forms of class complexity. Now, in this lecture and the next, we're adding a different kind of complexity. This is complexity that comes from the fact that the world in which we live consists of many different kinds of relations, not just class relations. And some of these non-class relations also have aspects of domination or oppression or other critical aspects. And there's complexity in terms of how class connects to these other forms of oppression. It's another form of complexity. So one way of thinking of what we're doing is we're building up your repertoire of complexities, in which the purpose is always to try to steer between over-complexification and oversimplification. And as I've said, I think the bigger danger is over-complexification, adding too much complexity for the task. Of course, you want to hit it bang right on the head. You want to get just the right amount of complexity. But I think in general, it's better to worry about being too complicated rather than too simple. So I want to introduce the problem of gender and the problem of race in order to add complexity, but in as coherent a way as possible that connects it as systematically as possible to the notion of, to the ideas of class. We will be looking at gender and race from the vantage point of class analysis, more than from the vantage point of gender analysis or race analysis. That's not to say that I'm privileging class, but that's the anchor for this course's material, because the course is obviously anchored in the Marxist tradition. Okay, first then some introductory points around this topic. both Marxism and feminism are emancipatory theoretical traditions. One way of characterizing these two traditions of theory is that they each anchor their analysis in a specific form of oppression in the existing world. Class oppression in the case of Marx, of class analysis, of Marxism, particularly class oppression as it centers around workers, and gender oppression, particularly as it centers around women in the case of feminism. Now, properly speaking, an account of gender oppression and gender relations is not a theory of the oppression of women. It's a theory of oppression generated by gender relations, which includes much more than just the oppression of women as such, although that's at the center. Just as class oppression is not just about the oppression and exploitation of workers, although in a capitalist society, the oppression and exploitation of workers is at the center of class oppression. Both theories focus especially on the consequences of these forms of relations of domination and oppression for the lives of people, and attempt to explain all sorts of social phenomena in terms of how those specific mechanisms work. And both are emancipatory theories because both are committed to the view that these forms of oppression are not natural, they're not inevitable, and they are in principle eliminable. And both traditions see the struggles of the oppressed groups or categories as central to the process of transformation. Neither Marxism nor feminism sees emancipation as a benevolent gift from the oppressor. Marxists do not look to the bourgeoisie to emancipate the working class, nor do feminists look to men to emancipate the lives of women, which doesn't mean they don't attempt to enlist men in the struggle for emancipation, but it's not a benevolent gift. It requires struggle. And intellectuals in both traditions believe that doing intellectual work around these themes in some way or other contributes to the realization of these emancipatory goals. That is, feminists are not engaged in the study of gender and its consequences and transformation just out of curiosity. It's also part of a commitment. Now, given this deep parallel character to the whole enterprise, one might have thought that Marxists and feminists would work really closely in tandem. This would be seen as two sides of a common project, mutually seeking to understand complex ways in which class and gender interact. But that really has not happened. There are exceptions. There are Marxist hyphen feminists or Marxists and feminists who collaborate and work together. But more often, Marxism and feminism relate to each other as rivals rather than as different dimensions of a common project. And in particular, although I think this has waned, as Marxism has waned as an intellectual current, particularly in academic contexts, but more broadly in the world, the intensity of feminist critiques of Marxism has declined as well. It's just not where the action is. Much of the energy around this difficult relationship has come from critiques of feminists of Marxism. Sometimes it's sympathetic critiques, it's kind of critiques in the hope of producing some reconciliation, and other times it's attacks rather than just critiques. The characteristic challenge against Marxist class analysis by sort of mainstream feminists involves the claim that Marxist class analysis is guilty of one or more of the following sins. So there's three typical accusations. One is that in Marxism, the concept of class is gender blind, whereas class relations are inherently gendered. That's one criticism. Second is that Marxist class analysis tends to reduce gender to class. Reduce, that's a kind of loaded term. That is, gender oppression is treated as if it is fully explained by class relations. Class is more fundamental. It explains the main contours of gender, would be that claim. That's the second critique of Marxism. And the third is an even stronger view, which says that Marxists treat gender inequality as epiphenomenal. That's E-P-I, phenomenal, epiphenomenal. Something is epiphenomenal, that accusation. If you want to attack somebody as saying, making a claim that something is epiphenomenal, what you're saying is that an epiphenomenon is an effect of something which isn't important for anything else. It's a surface appearance, which has no consequences in and of itself. So something is epiphenomenal when it looks important, but it isn't. It's the consequence of something, but it itself does not have consequences of importance. That's what the accusation of something being epiphenomenal. I don't think any of these criticisms are well-grounded. On the first one, that Marxism says class, the concept is gender blind, I don't actually think that's a weakness. I think it's a strength. It's desirable that the concept of class be gender blind, but that class analysis deeply engage the problem of gender. That is, we want class analysis to be fully engaged with understanding the connection between class and gender, but in order to understand the connection of class and gender, the concept of class itself shouldn't itself be gendered. The concept identifies some distinctive mechanisms, and then we want to understand how it interacts with gender, rather than packing in those gender interactions interior to the concept of class as such. The gender blindness of the concept of class is a virtue. A gender blind class analysis would be a problem. Secondly, there was a time when some Marxists saw class or related ideas like the economic structure or mode of production as fully explaining other forms of inequality. There was a time when some Marxists did that. No one makes that argument anymore. So, and no one really made the argument by the time feminists were attacking Marxists for this. They were attacking a kind of what's sometimes called vulgar Marxism. But vulgar Marxism was guilty more of silences than of positive claims. It isn't that in that kind of oversimplified then Marxist approach, people ever actually said that gender was explained by nothing other than class. It's just that they didn't say anything about it, and therefore by inference, it seemed like they were saying class was universally the most important determinant. In any case, nobody really says that anymore, so it's a kind of non-criticism. And on the criticism of epiphenomenality, you know, that gender is just a surface phenomenon, that's, when you encounter that criticism, somebody is just being polemical, because no one that I've never seen a theorist that says, even if they feel that capitalism and capitalist class relations substantially explain the form of gender relations, even if they say that, they say it because they believe the form of gender relations really matters, not because they think it's irrelevant, not because they believe it's surface phenomenon. So you can explain something, you can say class explains state policies without also believing that state policies don't matter. Indeed, why bother explaining state policies with class if you thought that state policies were epiphenomenal? State policies matter a lot in the lives of people, and they're explained by, or maybe explained by, class relations. So the third criticism is just simply wrong. Nobody says it. The second criticism, the reductionist criticism, has a grain of truth for some currents of Marxism, but is basically not the position that contemporary Marxists hold. And the first criticism shouldn't be a criticism. It's a strength of class analysis that its concept of class is gender neutral, gender blind, and class and race blind. It would be a criticism of class analysis, however, if gender is ignored in the concrete investigation of problems. Okay, that's just by way of introduction. What I'd like to do now, I have sort of three main topics, but I want to this time really leave us time for discussion, so I'm not going to just go on and on. I first want to talk about the joint effects of class and gender in explaining things, so I want to really think through what it means to talk about two different kinds of relations jointly having explanatory power and what it means to think about their interaction. Secondly, I want to talk about the ways in which class, excuse me, class and gender affect each other. What does it mean to say that we can have gender explanations of aspects of class relations and class explanations of aspects of gender relations? How should we think about their reciprocal causation? And then I want to talk about this problem of visions of emancipation, this general question of, I think I left the, something got left out of the outline here. I wanted to also talk about this historical, where did that go? There's this wonderful historical, this is what happened last night because I'm leaving on Thursday right after class. I did both lectures. I had in my mind one of the sections in the class for Thursday on race. Okay. If we have time at the end, I'm going to talk about that paper, a chapter from my book in which I compare the visions of emancipation in Marxism and feminism. But if we don't get to that, we can just talk about it in the discussion. Okay, first, interactions of class and gender. How to think about this. First point is to distinguish this problem when it's understood as a micro problem versus a macro problem. We haven't talked a lot about micro and macro issues yet. We will be talking about that contrast, micro and macro, especially when we come to the topic on, on ideology. Because the problem of ideology is precisely about the connection between macro and micro. Ideologies are inculcated in living persons, which means ideologies matter in the world because of the way they are incorporated into the subjectivity of persons. And that inherently means there's a micro practice and micro process involved in any discussion of ideology. Any discussion of ideology that ignores the micro level is essentially treating the mechanisms of ideology as black boxes. So a key issue in the discussion of ideology is, in fact, what are the mechanisms by which ideology has its consequences in the lives of people's subjectivity? And fundamentally, that requires that you engage in some cognitive psychology. I mean, there's no way around it. If you're going to have a theory of ideology that actually explains how people incorporate ideologies into their lives, you have to have a theory of cognitive psychology. It can be simple, but it's there implicitly. Okay, so, but we haven't really done a lot with the micro-macro stuff. At the micro level, understanding the lived experience, the micro level involves understanding the lived experiences, interests, subjectivities of individuals. And to understand that requires understanding how people occupy locations within gender relations, not just locations within class relations. People have life experiences, interests, subjectivities, all sorts of things happen to people by virtue of the locations they hold, they fill in a social structure. One of the locations which generates experience in people's lives are class relations, and another is gender relations. Now, this means you really need to think about what actually does the idea of a location within a relation mean. What is a location? What is a location within a relation? Now, this gets murky pretty quickly, so this will. I just want to do a little brief foray into what might be thought of as the meta theory of relations. To use a bit of Latin jargon, what is the relata of relations? What is it that relations relate? What are the things related within a relation? I think the way to think of this is the following. The relata, I like that word, you know, I suppose for many of you, this may be the first time you've ever heard the word relata, the relata within relations. I think the relata within relations are the interacting practices of people. Or if you want a less high-blown word, the interacting actions of people. The actions in which people engage that are inherently interactions with others. Now, not all actions you engage in are interactions with others, but some are, many are. It's a characteristic of every social species of which we are a premier example, that many of our activities are interactivities. They're activities which are inherently interactions with other people. A location is a location within sets of relationally interacting practices of different sorts. That's what's related. A location is a location within sets of relationally interacting practices. Relationally interacting practices. So in a classroom right now, we are engaged in relationally interacting practices, which are heavily normatively regulated. We all know how it works. We all have expectations about how our actions interact, how they fit together. I'm here talking. I gesture a lot. That's a particular mannerism of my particular way of talking. You're listening. Beginning of the 21st century, you are tapping away on your computers. That wasn't the case 20 years ago. Not even really 10 years ago. It's a relatively new thing. You're interacting. You're asking questions. These are all actions that are normatively regulated. That means we all have mutually understood rules about how this works. And through those mutually understood rules, the structure of these interactions gets stabilized. So we are in an extremely well-ordered environment here. Very little is up for grabs. We all know what to do. The relation between professors and students is a very well understood kind of social relation. And your location within that relation is also well understood by both you and me. So you have your own self-understanding of your role, and I have an understanding of your role, and you have an understanding of mine, et cetera, et cetera. And these all really mesh well. That's why it's all smooth, and you know how to do it. You're in all sorts of relations of this sort. Some of them are class relations that involve domination and hierarchy, rooted in control over resources. Some of them are gender relations, which are the ones we will be talking about today. But because it's the same people in these different relations, and these relations don't occur in separate spaces, I mean, in this space right here, this physical space with these bodies around this table, we're men and women engaged in gender relations and interactions, as well as professor, you know, student educational relations and interactions, as well as collegial relations and interactions, you know, particularly for those of you who I have an independent connection to through other ways because of the way academic life works, and the relations gradually embody both professor-student and colleague-to-colleague characteristics. This all gets really complicated. But one thing we're good at as human beings is understanding this complexity and having a tremendous capacity to understand the rules that govern the nature of these relations. But that's what's being related, the practices that are mutually expected and enforced. Now, power is involved in these kinds of relations when there's enforcement mechanisms to keep hierarchy and inequality in play within these intersecting interactions. But the main thing, you know, I want to resist just drifting off into the dreamland of meta-abstraction here. The main thing to keep in mind, I think, is that when we talk about social relations, we're talking about how human interactions, the practices of people, are systematically interconnected to each other. So it's relationally connected interactions. That's what relations are all about. When people insist that race and gender are important, when people insist on this for good reason, often they're really making the micro claim. That is, the locations people occupy within gender relations and racial relations impact their lives and experiences in critical ways. How people are located within these sets of interacting practices significantly shapes their life experiences. And this helps explain all sorts of things, like identities and other aspects of subjectivity, opportunities, life chances, and so on. That's the micro level. At the macro level, there is significant variation in the forms of gender relations, as well as class relations, of course, across societies or any other unit of analysis. And these variations in the forms of relations within a whole unit of analysis are also explanatory. So when we say that units of analysis vary in their class structure, what we mean is not just the micro statement is you identify a person as working class. They have these lived experiences. The macro statement is they are a worker in a class structure in which 70% of the population are working class or 10% of the population are working class. Now, the argument about the macro distribution is it's consequential to the lives of individuals, not merely what location they're in, but what kind of overall structure they're in. And that we can explain differences between outcomes at a societal level on the basis of the macro distribution of locations, not just the micro experiences of individuals. The interaction of class and gender involves understanding interactions at both the micro level of social relations and individuals' lives and the macro level of broader social institutions. Both of these are relevant to understanding the interaction of class and gender. Okay, let's now look at two domains of problems. First, the meaning of joint effects. What does it mean to talk about joint effects of two different kinds of relations? And secondly, how do we understand the reciprocal effects on each other of class and gender? So first, joint effects. There are, this analysis is premised on what could be called two basic theses. I mean, I'm kind of elevating this by saying it, thesis one and thesis two, but it's just a way of kind of anchoring these ideas. Thesis one is the distinct mechanisms thesis. I've already talked about this. To talk about class and gender as forms of oppression, we are attempting to identify distinct causal mechanisms. Class and gender are names for causal mechanisms or clusters of mechanisms that are located in specific aspects of relations. Distinct does not imply that the mechanisms don't affect each other or that in the world any given phenomenon is simply the effect of one or another. That's a separate matter. Distinct also doesn't prejudge the question of the extent to which changes in one might explain changes in another, but simply the idea of distinct mechanism simply affirms the point that these are not just disguised forms of the same thing. They're distinct mechanisms. One possible grounding for the autonomy of gender as a distinct mechanism, one possible grounding is sexuality. That's one way that theorists have tried to anchor. What are the real mechanisms embodied in the notion of gender relations? Gender oppression is generated in part through mechanisms through which sexual identities are formed. And these mechanisms are distinct from class exploitation. Another possible grounding for the relational aspects of gender is the problem of biological reproduction, the bearing and rearing of children, rather than sexuality as such. of course, sexuality and biological reproduction are connected, but they are not connected in the way that one is simply a reflection of the other. And it could be, and I think more, to me, it's the more powerful idea, is that it's biological reproduction that is the grounding for the distinct social creation of gender as a set of mechanisms, more than sexuality per se. And sexuality enters into the formation of gender relations via its connection to reproduction and child rearing. To say that gender oppression constitutes a mechanism distinct from class means that it generates distinctive effects. That's what distinct mechanism means. The whole idea here is that the word mechanism is a way of talking about causal processes that generate consequences or effects. And to say that gender constitutes a distinct mechanism means it also produces distinct effects that can be identified as the effects of gender. This implies that in our analysis of various social questions, whatever you might be wanting to study, you know, voting, consciousness, income inequality, conflict, you know, any topic that you're interested in, we face the task of trying to sort out the distinctive ways in which class and gender bear on those outcomes, are implicated in generating the particular consequences or effects that we observe. That's the distinct mechanisms thesis. Now the interaction effects thesis. This one, I think, is a little harder to... This is one of these ideas that you're going to revisit many times. It's a little harder than just the distinct mechanisms idea. So while different forms of oppression identify distinctive causal mechanisms, so different types of oppression are each associated with distinct generative processes, causal mechanisms, in the world, these mechanisms interact with each other. If you want a bumper sticker, you know, you can add to your collection of bumper stickers, the world is not additive. The world is not additive. This is really of fundamental importance. And, you know, you can really, if you want to, you can call it the structural interactions thesis. Causes don't operate in an additive manner in general. They operate in an interactive manner. This involves the rejection of two possible claims. First, the view that the category class should be regarded as inherently gendered. I've already explained why we should reject that. Class and gender are ways of identifying distinct mechanisms, and our task is to understand their interaction. But the view that these, it also involves a rejection of the view that these mechanisms only have additive effects. That is, the effects of class do not in part depend upon gender. Excuse me. This is a little bit, I mean, here's an analogy, which is an imperfect one, but it might help a little bit understand what I'm talking about. In chemistry, we know that water, the compound water, consists of two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen, H2O. It is incorrect to argue that the effects of water on plants is the additive effect of the effect of hydrogen on plants and the effect of oxygen on plants. The effects of water on plants is the effects of a particular form of interaction of hydrogen and oxygen, which generates the effects that enable plants to grow. So the effects of water on plants cannot be decomposed into a separable effect of hydrogen and a separable effect of oxygen, even though hydrogen and oxygen are distinct mechanisms. And it's their form of combination that generates the effects of water. It's not something else. The effects of water isn't something other than the effects of hydrogen and oxygen when they interact in a particular way. So the form of interaction is where all the action is in the case of chemistry. The compound water is a tightly interactive system which generates a compound which has properties distinct from the properties of its components. It's why the aphorism, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, makes sense. But note, with respect to water, the whole is not greater than the sum and interaction of its parts. The whole is nothing other than, water is nothing other than the sum and interaction of its parts. There's nothing else there. There's no mysterious property to water that is something other than the sum and interaction of its parts. But its effects in the world on plants is not decomposable into the separable effects of hydrogen and oxygen. Okay, that's what interaction means. You have distinct mechanisms, but the effects in the world come from the forms of interaction and combination of them. And in the world, in some cases, as in the water case, you can't then decompose the effects into the separable components. Now, one way of expressing this in the social case is by a little equation. This is a really simple, conventional linear equation with an interaction term. So you're trying to explain something. We'll call that X. That's your explanandum, another Latin word. Explanandum is the same as dependent variable, but it's a little more highfalutin, right? So the explanandum is X, and we can think of X as being affected by class V1, effects of, that shows you how powerful the effect of class is on whatever it is you're explaining. B2 is the effects of gender, and B3 is the effects of the compound, gender by class. This, you can think about this in the kind of diagrammatic way that I've presented below. In the first case, we're exploring something that we think of as the consequence of gender. So gender relations help explain variations in the intensity and form of, let's say, sexual harassment, various types of sexual conflicts within daily life between men and women. That's of an effect of gender. It's not an effect of class. Gender mechanisms are implicated in the production of sexual encounters and the fraught nature of those encounters that we then describe as or categorize as sexual harassment. But class can affect the extent and forms of sexual harassment. Sexual harassment will take different forms in working class settings than in managerial or bourgeois settings, that the character and consequences of sexual harassment will vary by class. So an interaction model does not say that sexual harassment is a class phenomenon. Sexual harassment is itself something generated by the gender relations of the society. But how it affects gender how it generates those consequences will be affected by the class context in which it occurs. Similarly, we can say that gender interacts with class. So think of something that is a distinctive effect of class, the intensity and forms of exploitation. Material extraction of labor effort in production is a class phenomenon. That is what class relations generate. But the intensity and forms of class exploitation may be shaped by the nature of gender relations. So gender interacts in shaping the effects of class. The arrows in these little diagrams goes from one variable to an arrow rather than from one variable to another. That's what an interaction means. The idea of interaction in these illustrations implies that in the little equation above, that B3 is an important variable. But it may not be. You know, I regard this as highly dependent upon the thing you're attempting to explain. It could be that class and gender each have their own additive effects. They each contribute to some phenomenon. And that their effectiveness is independent of the presence of the other, so that there is no interaction. It's not that there is some meta-argument that says for everything you might want to explain, the interaction term is significant. The claim that class is inherently gendered is basically the claim that B1 is always zero. That is, the claim that it is inextricably gendered means that there never is an additive effect. Its effects are always entirely contained within the interaction term. The claim that gender is always classed would be that B2 is always zero in that equation. In this general abstract model, there is no universal presumption that class is more important than gender. That is, the claim that class is more important, in quotes, than gender would mean that B1 is always bigger than B2. There's no claim. It all depends upon what you're explaining and what the context is. And there's no presumption that B3 is always where the action is. So there's some writing in contemporary sociology often goes under the rubric of intersectionality, which essentially argues that the intersection of these processes is always where the action is. And that seems to me an ungrounded claim. It's often where the action is. In many problems, looking at those interaction terms, and you know, I'm saying it in a more mechanical way here in the form of an equation, is the place where one should focus research. But that's a discovery rather than a premise. The distinct mechanism says you identify the distinct mechanisms and then study how they both individually contribute to some phenomenon you're studying and through their interactions. Yeah.
So how, if the interaction is perhaps where you, like, where some of the effects are compounded, how do you get to the place where
Well, you don't then. It's their co-present that is the explanatory process. So
then why is intersectionality, like, unfounded?
No, it's it's that there may also be additive effects, that's all. So there can be both additive and interactive effects. You know, there's no it's just the grand claim that all the action is in the intersection, as opposed to that's one of the things we have to attend to. That's where I think the argument is overstated. Yeah.
So, if you conduct a statistical analysis, you would have kind of thousands of cases. And then cases, when there are some alternatives of gender, some options which influence. There are no options of class which influence, and there are options of only class influence. And there are combined kind of options when people have higher positions, like kind of certain general options, and then influence. So we have kind of classes of cases and see which combination influences. This is how we can statistically kind of see the effects.
Yeah, I understand it from a statistical perspective. I'm just saying, I think in reality it's very hard to say. Like, I am a class person and not a gendered person because I come as a class, gendered, and racial person.
Right, but so the fact that both men and women workers experience being fired because they lack means of production, they lack job protections, and that the power of capital enables the employer to decide you're fired. That's a class experience that's generated by class experience. And it's identifiably a consequence shared in common by virtue of class. But other aspects of the experience at work of male and female workers will be conditioned by their gender. And, you know, it just requires specificity to assess where the separable effects of class and gender are and where the interactive effects lie. Okay. The effects of class and gender on each other. So first, because it's a little less familiar, the effects of gender on class. There are two main ways that gender relations affect class. So first, gender shapes the way people are connected to or tied to the class structure. Gender is one of the processes which explains how people are connected to the class structure. It does this, for example, by allocating people to class locations. Discrimination affects the probabilities of getting into a particular class or not. For example, gender discrimination in credit markets. So credit markets have a gendered aspect to the extent that sources of capital are less likely to lend capital to women with a particular project than to men. That would be a gendered effect on the way men and women get allocated to class structures. Or through direct exclusions. There was a time in the United States when there were actual marriage bars to certain kinds of employment. If you got married, you couldn't hold certain jobs. School teachers in the United States and in some places and times had to be unmarried. In the Netherlands, school teachers had to be unmarried until the 1950s. You know, if you got married and you were a school teacher, you lost your job. And pretty astounding nowadays to think of that. So one way that gender shapes class is it shapes the way people are tied to class structure. But gender also, through allocation, but also gender shapes the indirect connections of people to class structure, what I call mediated connections through families. That's the central theme in the debate over John Goldthorpe's approach to class, where he wants to argue that the class location of married women is always defined by the class of their husbands, who are the head of household, whereas his critics were arguing that the class of married women depends upon their own position in the class structure, not just their husbands. And I argue that it's actually both, that everybody's class position is shaped both by their direct location and their mediated locations, because what it means to have a location is to have your material interests shaped by class relations, and if you're married to a capitalist, your class interests are different than if you're married to a factory worker, regardless of what your own job class might be. But they both matter. that's a second way that gender affects class. Gender, I mean, that's still part of the this first point, the shaping how people are connected to the class structure. The second issue, which is a really interesting one and not given a whole lot of attention, is the way gender relations actually shape the nature of class structures, not just how people are sorted into them. an example from American history is that particular gender relations around the social standing of unmarried daughters in farming families in 19th century New England were really important for the creation of working class textile jobs. The whole textile industry in New England, which created massive working class positions, was heavily dependent upon the availability of a labor force of unmarried farmers' daughters who worked in the textile mills for 5, 8, 10 years as teenagers and young adults until they got married. without that availability and a different gender order with different agrarian practices would have blocked that, there would not have been a textile industry in New England, at least some historians have argued. That was the source of labor for them. Very different from the development of the textile industry in New York City, which relied on immigrant labor. Different structure. So gender relations can actually shape the way in which class structures develop because of the way they shape the availability of potential labor forces. the effects of class on gender. Okay, well, I'm now confronting the inevitable collision of the complexity of ideas and the constraints of clocks. Because this involves, the effects of class on gender involves a important and difficult methodological issue, which has to do with the relationship between two different kinds of explanations, two different ways in which we could think of how class relations might affect gender relations. One is via what's called a functional explanation, and one is via what's called an interest explanation. We will be discussing this contrast many times in the semester. It comes to play in our discussion of the state, comes into play in our discussion of ideology as well. Functional explanations versus interest explanations. And there's no way I can explain this in 3 minutes and give examples. And so we face a juncture here. I think let's do it this way. Let's take our break now. Come back and have sort of 20 minutes of discussion or so till, 20, 25 after. Then I'll do the functional and interest explanation, and we'll discuss that part of it. And I think that means probably the visions of emancipation part, that part of the readings, I'm not going to be able to explicitly talk about in the lecture. But let's take our break now rather than me launch into this. So think of issues you want to raise on what we've talked about so far, and then we'll move on to the next part of the discussion.